Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off! Welcome to another fucking family fun size fuck stick fan club. My name is Nick, and this is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to fucking fan club. Oh, fucking hell. I'm really nervous about our guest that we've got coming
up. Oh, am I? It's quite exciting. He's quite a big deal. And I don't know what it's going to be like.
It's for the first time I've ever... it might actually be a better interview than normal, because it's the first time...
Yeah, I think so.
I've actually written down questions just to sort of, like, guide me through it. But, yeah. All right. As long as we're both...
as long as we're both nervous, it would be fine.
As long as we're both nervous, it'll be all right.
We're in this together.
Well, sure, but if it goes badly, I'm throwing you under the bus now.
You can leave the meeting, Nick.
I would never do that. Imagine that. Imagine if I just left the meeting. Oh, God. Oh, yeah. So this is week 8 or 9 of Camp COVID.
It's been week 8, apparently. Week 8 of lockdown, is it?
Yeah, week 8 of lockdown. So week 10 for me. I don't want to be like a boastful Boris. Oh, no. Like a negative Nelly, but Boris is actually the Prime Minister. So probably the wrong choice. A boastful Benny. But I've been locked up 2 weeks longer than everyone else.
You got ill 2 weeks, exactly 2 weeks before lockdown, right? And then...
Yeah, I got Rona 2 weeks before lockdown, I think. I'm assuming it was Rona. I'm waiting for one of those tests that's going around.
Not seen
it. My neighbour's got one, and so they said they'd lend it me when they've done with it. So that'll be good. Fucking hell! So this is live from. It's not live. It's pre-recorded on Wednesday.
But doing it as live.
Yeah, recorded live, obviously. Recorded live. Broadcast 2 days later. Less than 2 days.
About 44 hours. We're about 44 hours behind you guys that are listening live. And who knows how long if you're listening on a podcast.
We both might be dead. Or Nat might be.
What is the first rule of fan club?
First rule of fan club is wash your hands.
We should have that.
First rule of fan club is tell your friends, get 2 meters away from your friend and tell them, hey, have you listened to fan club? And when they say no, just lend them your your earphones.
And, I'm do that now. I don't know if you should do. You can't hand them your earphones. Can you? Does it go through ears?
You're not allowed to share earphones.
I wouldn't have thought so.
Oh, fuck.
What have you done?
Well, I think I've probably got corona then.
Again?
I've been sticking other people's headphones up my arse and then turning the volume up really loud. The vibrations are amazing. I went to see, we might have talked about it, I went to see Solomon Gray, who was like an ex-fan clubber.
Yeah.
He came on the show like last year, maybe, and we probably mentioned it in the thing. Their bass line is so low and it's so loud. Basically, you go and see them and... You can just hear their music. You just feel their music vibrating through your arsehole. One of the best gigs I've ever been to. Have to say.
Was there a worry that you might hit yourself or anything there?
Nah, absolutely not, mate. I've got full control when it comes to that.
Well done. And what's the second rule of fan club?
First rule of fan club is tell your friend. Second rule of fan club is shit your pants.
You've got to do social socially distant, so hopefully as far away from someone else as possible. Certainly in that regard, you don't want to be close to anyone.
Absolutely. What I've learned is that, you know, I love doing this show. I really love doing the show. I love seeing you every week. I've always been a fan of you, Nat, and it's good to be able to work with you. And what I've learned is that this is a show that I really believe in, and I really want to get like good listening figures. And every week I tweet, you know, oh, we've done another show, and it'll get like 3 likes from the same people every week, and then I'll do one joke about wanking and it'll get 1,000 likes, right? And this is, you know, wanking jokes just come to me, you know. But this is sort of like, this takes a bit of work and a bit of prep, but now it's up and running, it's kind of like fine. So when we say tell your friends, basically just retweet the fuck out of it, for fuck's sake. Otherwise, it's just pathetic.
we can't be doing this to the same people every week.
So that's the second rule of fan club. that's the new slogan. Oh, I am in a good mood. That's a nice mug. Did I get you that mug?
You did get me it. Thank you, Nick. It's a David Bowie mug.
You don't need to keep thanking me, but I'm getting old and I forget how generous I've been. right, okay. Well, aren't we in a good mood? That's going to change. So what do we normally do? What have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel?
Yeah, what have I watched this week? I'll tell you what I watched. I watched Reign of Fire, the Christian Bale, Matthew McConaughey dragon movie.
The disappointing dragon movie where the posters were better than the movie.
No, I love it. I love it. Second time, especially when it came out, loved it. Watched it again, still love it. Big fan.
Really?
Big fan.
The posters were good, though, weren't they?
Well, they were good. I like that it's like the dragons are found on the extension of the London Docklands, and I quite like that as a little plot. It's like quite, it's a nice little detail that it's got a proper existing thing.
Yeah, do you know what I've learned? I was thinking about this in the week. It's really weird. But the posters for Reign of Fire were all like pictures of Big Ben that were getting set ablaze by dragons flying through the air. And it's one of those weird things where there's a prologue at the beginning where they're in the Docklands and they discover a dragon. And then it cuts forward. It jumps through the exciting bit. And then it cuts forward 30 years or however long to the future, where it's just like, it's the last remnants of civilization because we've all been wiped out by dragons. And you go, no, skip back a bit. That's your movie. So it's like they said, we want to do this, like, it's a dragon-y version. The posters made it look like it's a dragon-y version of Independence Day.
Yeah, and they could, I suppose, do some kind of prequel, midquel version of the film as well.
It was sort of like, it's Mad Max meets Dragon Slayer, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like what they do. It's like they've reverted mankind back to medieval times. So it's sort of like a medieval epic, but it's about them. There's a bit when they're sort of like retelling Star Wars and stuff like that, aren't they? As like one of their myths.
Yeah.
Which was an optimistic look because now Star Wars is dead and no one's going to remember it in 5 years. But, dragons or not.
If the dragons had come in 2005, it would probably be a lot more present in people's minds. Yeah.
Accurate. Yeah, what I was thinking was that Thor the Dark World gets loads of like negative press, right? Everyone hates Thor the Dark World. And I would say out of all of the Marvel films, aside from Captain America, which was on my phone, you know, when I bought it, it was sort of like a digital transfer and I sort of like ended up with it on my phone. So I ended up watching Captain America like 3 times, maybe in little bits and pieces. But Thor the Dark World is the only Marvel movie that I've actually deliberately sat down and watched more than once, like for fun. Yeah. And I really like Thor the Dark World. And I think the reason is because there's a scene when he's on the underground.
Yeah.
And I just like seeing the underground on film.
I know what you mean, though. I do. You see, you should like Reign of Fire, then, because that's literally about the Docklands. So it should be.
I remember I've been to the Docklands. I went to the Docklands when they opened it. Oh, God, they must have been working on that for ages then. Yes. The Docklands?
Oh, yeah, no, it was open. It's been open since the 90s, isn't it? Docklands Light Railway.
Oh, no, maybe it was they did an extension of the line then. And that's what I went to. I think I saw Boris Johnson do a speech. I think it was before he was Prime Minister and he was just this wacky guy. And I went with David Trim. And this sounds like a humble brag now, but I was in the Evening Standard 100 Names That You Should Know. I got some sort of plaque or something like that. And they get loads of people from all these different professions and disciplines, and they invite you all to it was like on the DLR. I think there was like a new branch of the DLR. It was just opening, and we got to sort of look around and see the process of it. It was actually really interesting. There was like a whole museum kind of like layout thing. It's really interesting. You look around it, but what you realise is basically it's a brand awareness thing. It's not a prize. It's like all things, you know, it's like what the British Comedy Awards turned into. It's kind of like, it's a little bit an award ceremony, but basically it's so that Lidl are sponsoring it and it's basically free advertisement for them, but in the guise of a award ceremony. It's like the Foster's Awards. It's the Comedy Awards sponsored by Foster's, but everyone called them the Foster's Awards. It's quite a good thing to get attached to. So I went to this Evening Standard thing. They invited, I think it was 1,000 names, you know, and you got like athletes.
Yeah, worse by the minute. It was 100 before.
Like I think, yeah, but that's the thing. It's like 1,000 names or 100 names that you must know, right? For the year, I guess it was 2015 or 2016. You know, Sarah Pascoe was on the list, you know, but it's like athletes and actors and musicians and, you know, politicians and all this other stuff. And basically what they do is they're casting their net wide, because even in comedy, I've got a different fan base to Sarah Pascoe, you know. And so I go, hey, I got this Evening Standard Award. She goes, hey, I got this Evening Standard Award. And we're broadcasting it to all of our groups of people. But then if you're not into comedy, don't worry, we've got the athletes covered. We've got the politicians covered. We've got the scientists covered. You know, so it's like every single demographic is covered. And they say, hey, come and celebrate yourself for an evening, and you do, then they take a photo of you on the way out with Evening Standard behind you, broadcast it everywhere, and it's brand awareness, basically. Anyway, this thing, Boris Johnson went up and he did a joke about prostitutes. It was like this absolutely baffling moment where you're just like, oh, what?
Was it a controversial thing at the time?
I don't think it would have got in the papers. I think the only people that were covering it were the Evening Standard, and they were probably grateful that he'd come to do a speech. But it was just like, it's really like distasteful, unpleasant sort of like joke. And he's just like, come on, mate. I don't think he was the mayor at the time. Yeah, anyway, it was a really weird thing. Anyway, that's absolutely... Anyway, so yeah, so I'm a big fan of Rain of Fire.
Docklands, which opened officially in 1987... probably what were extended in 2015.
They'll use that as the clip.
I always go, oh, really? Was that the bit? Was that the bit pulled out?
It was me briefly mentioning that Piers Morgan was a cunt last week. And he's like, no, I'm not going to retweet that. He's already destroyed Nish Kumar. I don't want to be next in line. Fuck you. Oh, fucking hell, I don't want to fight with Piers Morgan. So, right, so tell us about Rain of Fire. Who directed it?
Rob Bowman was the guy. He did the X-Files movie, and he did episodes of the X-Files. I think that's how he got into it. I think he was a TV director who then ended up doing the movie, and then from that tried to expand into a further movie career. I've always been a big fan of Rain of Fire, though. I think it's a better film. I think it's a really silly film. But I think it knows what it is and really plays up to that kind of quite silly, big action movie. And it's one of, like, Christian Bale does that thing as well where he discovers the dragons at the start in the Docklands extension. And I think he's meant to have... I don't know if that's why. I think he's meant to have, like, burnt vocal cords a bit. So in the future, he sounds like Frank Butcher from EastEnders.
Well, he's doing like a Cockney accent, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's like... It's properly British, post-apocalyptic. But when was it made?
I think it's 2005, I think.
So is it after Batman Begins?
It might be. It might be. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah, it must be a year or two.
No, no, it can't be 2005, surely, because he went straight from The Machinist.
2002.
Right, yeah. So it was after American Psycho, but before Batman Begins. Yeah, sure, okay.
Because
he lost so much weight for The Machinist that when he went on to do Batman Begins, he had to put on loads of muscle, but he put on too much. And he basically got really, he didn't just get muscly, he got fat for doing Batman. And then he had to lose weight again because he did it so quickly.
There's that thing this week about Robert Pattinson, who's apparently in lockdown somewhere, and he's got his personal trainer who's saying, make sure you keep up on your training for Batman. And in this interview, he's just gone, I'm not. I'm just eating. He's like, can't do anything. Can't get to me. We're in lockdown.
fuck them. It's like, there might be Bond reshoots, and Daniel Craig's just like, well, fucking, you can CGI my muscles back on. I'm not fucking, what, I've got to do all that training in the off chance I'm allowed out to do some filming at some point in the next 10 months. That's what, is it Zoe Kravitz, who's playing Catwoman?
Oh, right, yeah.
She just said, they were like saying, make sure you keep up with your training. And she just said, nah, you just better let the Catwoman suit out a couple of sizes. It's like all the actors are getting rebellious. They're just like, what do you want? What are you going to do about it? Are you going to come over here?
They're talking about it now, aren't they? Starting up a film production again. How is it possibly going to work? You're going to have to film people being 2 metres apart all the time.
The sound is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
Actually, the sound will probably be all right because of the boom mics. They can...
That'll extend. They can do that, probably.
And then I guess they'll just use Zooms.
It'll be like this. It'll be like a feature film.
I mean, imagine that. I bet it's been pitched. We'd make a movie, feature length. We can get all the stars in, and we'll do it on Zoom. It'll be Ben Affleck and Joaquin Phoenix having a Zoom chat. Where'd you keep your Oscars? Just behind me.
That'd be the temptation, wouldn't it? To just have people just report all their Oscars behind them, like
all of the movie stars, and they just put their Oscars out. Adam Sandler would have his Golden Raspberry Awards and his MTV Best Kiss.
What did you get that for?
Didn't they get something for an hour pronounced Chuck and Larry or something like that?
Okay.
I'm making it up, I'm assuming.
Does it feel like you've had things coming through again that are like, oh, maybe we'll start filming on X date, or is everything still...
No. To be fair, I didn't get that before lockdown either. I would be very surprised, you know. Yeah, people saying, oh well, I'm not getting as many emails. I'm getting just as many. If not more. I'm getting more.
Great. It's great being in lockdown. Absolutely. It is a worry. I do worry about all these kind of, I've got this thing now, I don't know whether I'm thinking about I haven't ridden a bike since I was about 10, and I'm thinking about getting on one of the Boris bikes just to see if I can do it, because I'm sort of thinking, when this lockdown starts lifting and they go, everything get back to normal, it's like, I don't know if I want to be on the tube. So I'm now thinking, do I now start trying to ride a bike? But I think this will be a terrible idea. I've got no idea if I can ride a bike. They say you never forget, but I think I'm going to sit on that bike and it's going to go one way and I'm going to end up on the floor. I've got nothing to fucking do.
That's the age-old fear, isn't it? I reckon now is the best time to see if you can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. How you feel about riding on the tube again and things like that?
I hated it anyway.
So it's just got to be the same?
I've got an actual excuse not to do it now. Yeah. Other than the fact that mental health and anxiety and all of that stuff, I've got an actual reason, which is, you know, corona, not to get, you know, just in case anyone's in any doubt. Oh, God.
Corona, what's this?
Corona? Oh, fucking hell. Do you remember Joe Wicks? Fucking hell. So long ago. I mean, so, Go on.
I was just going to say, it's now we sort of thinking, oh yeah, there's other bits of like the beginning of the lockdown that now feel like completely different eras, especially with what like government advice is. They start like out like, oh yeah, we're going to be doing this. And then a couple of days later, it just sort of goes and you've got to think back and go, wait, what about all that other stuff we're meant to be doing? Because if it's anything that they have to rely on, it just doesn't really happen. If it's like, well, the one way we're going to get back to work is if we start testing people. And then a couple of weeks later, all that kind of goes out the window and they can't do it. And they go, yeah, maybe just go back to work anyway. See what happens. See what happens. Isn't that really dangerous? Well, no one knows for sure unless we actually do it. So maybe let's give it a go. See what happens.
Well, I've been thinking about a couple of things. One of them was about Georgia reopening hair salons and tattoo parlours. And I was thinking, at first you go, that is fucking crazy. And also, how redneck can you get that it's kind of like, and it's sort of like, feels like it's the government pandering to a certain demographic of people, which is like, well, we'll keep them happy because we've got an election coming up. And they're our core demographic, like, you know, bikers that want tattoos. I know that everyone has tattoos now, but it's just kind of like, you know, but then I was thinking, and I don't believe that there has been sort of any thought put into it whatsoever other than pandering to a demographic.
Yeah.
But I do think that if you were to open all the tattoo parlours, that's actually not a bad place to start. Because if you were to open up cinemas, restaurants, obviously supermarkets are open, but if you were to make like places with mass appeal and mass demand, pubs, yeah. You know, they were just like, oh, we might open up pub gardens. Have you ever been into a pub garden on a summer's day? It's absolutely fucking rammed, right? That is more dangerous than just opening up a pub, right? Yeah. People have just been fucking, you know, I always just think of the Pear Tree up in Edinburgh during the festival where it's just shoulder to shoulder, you know, there's like nine deep at the bar. It's just like, if you open up a fucking pub and you're just saying everyone's got to practice social distancing, you can fuck that right off. That's never going to happen. You open up a tattoo parlour, who wants to get a tattoo? Who's so desperate right now, like chomping at the bit to get a tattoo, right? It's probably not many old people, right? Yeah. And so it's such a niche thing, right? Yeah. Even if you're covered in tattoos, I think you can probably wait a bit before you actually go out and get a tattoo. So if you open up a tattoo parlour, yeah, sure, people can go and get tattoos, but also it's a one-on-one activity, right? Where they've probably got a face mask anyway.
And gloves, rubber gloves.
And gloves, right? So they're probably all sort of like, you know, covered up anyway when they're doing it. It's a one-on-one thing. So it's not like you've got like 20 people in a room. You've got two people in a room. And there's not going to be like a huge queue like for the supermarket go around the block. There'll be, you know, there's like 1, 2, 3 tattoo parlours down Holloway Road. And I go past them and they're always empty. And it's just kind of like, yeah, you open up the tattoo parlours. It's a really good sort of like, maybe it's a kind of a quite a clever testing ground to go, well, we open it. It seems like such a random thing to open. But then you go, actually, if you just open them all up, then it's a good way to say, well, have the people with tattoos been spreading corona? And if they haven't, then let's sort of like open up like the next thing, you know, pornographic bookshops, you know.
That would be great if that was the next thing.
We're opening up wank shops and tattoo parlours. Brilliant. And
basically at the bottom of Berwick Street will be open up and nothing else in London.
Absolutely brilliant. I'm going to get my cock ring extended. And I'm going to get an extra cock hole put in. No, it's fine. I've been wanting to do it for ages, but I've been able to get out because of Rona. So I'm going to get a hole punctured into my cock, and then I'm going to get a tattoo to celebrate it. And then I'll probably leave the Razzle Mags for a couple of weeks while my cock heals. But as soon as it does, I'm going in there. I still use magazines. I'm old school. I've still got dial-up. I have more of a connection, a tactile connection with paper, really. Doesn't have to be pornographic. Any Argos catalogue, that gets me going. So I think tattoo parlours are quite good.
Oh, you're probably right. Yeah, it's a niche thing, isn't it? So if people go, well, we demand tattoo parlours are open, it's probably a good thing to go, sure, go for it.
Sure, yeah, as long as you practice social distancing. Yeah. How big is the queue going to be? Do you know what I mean? So that's what I thought about that. The other thing I was thinking about was the relativity of time, Nathaniel.
Wow, you have been thinking.
Yeah.
Do you mean in this instance, how it sort of speeds up and slows down, or seems to?
Yeah, it's mental, right? So 6 o'clock might as well be midnight for me at the moment. It's sort of like, I think that the morning zips by, right? So I woke up at whatever time, like 10 o'clock this morning. And before I knew it was 3 o'clock, and I was just like, oh God, I better have lunch, right? So I had lunch and now I'm here, we're doing this. This will finish at 6. And then before you know it, it's going to be another day gone. And today is Wednesday, so that's the whole of Wednesday taken up. So tomorrow's Thursday, which is practically the weekend, and then we're next Monday, right? Yeah. So I find
it crazy. I think it changed. Like, I know people are talking about being bored and things. I cannot believe how quickly a day goes or a week goes. And even when you're saying it's 8 weeks of lockdown, I'm like, what? 8 weeks? When you think about that in terms of like a real normal span of time, you'd be like, yeah, that was ages ago. This just feels like it's zipping by.
I can't even remember if we talked about this last week. I had a gig just before lockdown. It could have been 2 weeks ago. It could have been 100 years ago. I've got no idea. But so this is what I mean about relativity, right? And so sometimes before lockdown, like, I tell you what, so I was busy the last 2 weeks recording music, right? And the days were sort of like quite long because I was busy and I was doing stuff and I was going from room to room and I was working on things and using my brain. And the weeks just felt, those 2 weeks felt really long, right? Whereas this week is just like zip by, right? Now, this is going to go off on a slight tangent, right? So when they made The Rise of Skywalker, yeah?
Go on.
Right? When they made The Rise of Skywalker, they tested the film for Disney, right? And the production for Rise of Skywalker was troubled. Yeah, they had like three different edits. They had a George Lucas cut, they had a Kathleen Kennedy cut, and they had a J.J. Abrams cut. And they were all pushing different things, and they showed all three of the cuts, and basically none of them were good enough. And they were refilming scenes right up until maybe 10 days before it got released. And they were re-editing it and doing all of that. So when they... At the end of Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, there is a scene where Lando and all of the other planets, they arrive right at the end in all of their thousands of spaceships to save the day, right? That scene was added quite late, right? So you go, how did they create all of those spaceships? So the way they did it was they went through all of the films that they'd made, like Rogue One and... all of the stuff that Lucasfilm have got on standby, you know, like sort of stuff from the TV series that they've made and Solo and, you know, all three of the films that they made and all of the assets that they had at Lucasfilm. And they just reused lots of the models and repositioned them. Yeah. And then they gave some of them a paint job and they put like dents in some of them and they copied and pasted them. But that's how they did it. Right. Which is kind of like you go, fucking hell, they did a lot of special effects in a short amount of time. Those spaceships were pre-existing assets, which they could reuse. Right.
Yeah.
So the way I think about it is this. When I have a meeting, let's just say on an average day, out of lockdown. I've got 5 meetings in Soho, right? I've got to get my cock ring put in. Right? I've got to eat some ramen. I've got to have a couple of my ideas for TV shows rejected. Got to pop into FOP. Remember that you don't work there anymore, and then I'll skulk around Soho Theatre until someone recognises me, right? So those are 5 things that I've got to do on an average day in Soho, right? 5 important meetings, yeah? So every time I go out and I do stuff, let's say I go to a restaurant that I've never been to before, my brain is processing that information for the first time, yeah? And it's building in my head an asset of that room, yeah? And it takes time to do that. So time is slowing down because there's so much information that's being bombarded at me. Let's say I meet a new person for the first time. I'm processing their face, I'm remembering how they smell, I'm remembering their voice, you know, all of this other stuff that's happening in my head. In the back of my head, subconsciously, I'm creating new assets of these new environments, of these new people. And so because of that, because I'm busy and all these things are happening, time is slowing down, right? When I'm living at home in my flat for 8 weeks, yeah, I go into my living room, right, and I've already got all of that information, yeah? So I'm not creating new information in my head. I go into my room. When I first moved into my flat, it would be sort of like, and when I was sort of like decorating my flat and putting up artwork and stuff, but even now, if I put up a new picture, my eyes will be drawn to that picture and I'll be like, oh, I love that picture that I've just put up. That goes in the perfect place, but I'm processing where it is. And then after a couple of days, I stop noticing it, right? And it's just part of the background. So what might happen is I go into my living room at dusk, and I haven't been in my living room at dusk before, but I've been in my living room before, and the walls are a different sort of shade that I've not noticed before. So I'm sort of like processing information like that. But basically what I'm doing is I'm painting an asset, you know? It's like I'm doing a paint job on an asset that I already own. I'm not creating the room from scratch anymore. I'm just giving it a different colour, right? Yeah. And when you're in your house for 8 days, because your brain isn't constantly slowing down to process new information, the time just zips by, right? It's like when old people say that time goes by so quickly. That is A, because let's just say you're 100 years old, 1 year is a hundredth of your time on the planet. Whereas if you're 3 years old, 1 year is a third of your time on the planet. Mm. So time operates differently like that. But also it's the fact that if you're in like a nursing home or a care home, then it's kind of like your frame of reference, well, let's say you're off sick at school, right? And you're in bed all day, yeah? When you're at school, you're learning stuff and the weeks just fucking drag for ages. But when you have a day off, that just it's over like that. Or if you're on your school holidays for 6 weeks, you know, and let's say you do go on holiday, but the holiday goes really quick because you get used to your villa, like, or your holiday home or wherever you are. You get used to that, and then your holiday goes really quickly. But when you're at school, you're kind of learning. There's new information being given to you all the time, so time slows down again. So the weeks are long, and the weekends go just fly by because you're used to your home a lot more than you are at your school. I think that when they say time is relative, it's not necessarily about the individual, but it's about what you're doing with your time.
Maybe that is what Stephen Hawking's book is about, but you've just told us it in actual time. I think all that makes perfect sense. I was thinking
I got to link it to Rise of Skywalker as well.
Well done. I was thinking as well to link it to something else. When it's a bit like as well in Deep Red, where he comes into the building and he spots something at the corner of his eye which is different from when he was in the place before, and he knows there's something, and that's why subconsciously as an audience we also realize that there's something different about the room we've just been in, and that is the whole kind of puzzle of the film. Mm. I won't spoil it for anyone, but watch the film, it is excellent. But there is something why you as an audience that's based on the idea that you're shown something once, when you're shown the same thing again, you subconsciously pick up slight differences. And that is sort of based on that same principle. I had a thing today, actually. I went to, I put some washing on and 10 minutes later, I went upstairs and went, did I actually turn that on? I had to go back and check. And I think you're right. It's that sort of contracted time, is that when your brain takes in information, if it's something you do all the time, you don't really remember if you've done, you can't say, oh, I definitely turned that on, because it's so familiar. So you find yourself going back and checking things like, did I do that? I did do it.
But also, it's like your brain isn't making new memories. So so you go, I know I switched on the washing machine at some point, but it might not have been today. It might have been a week ago or yesterday. And so you have to sort of like double check little things like that, because your brain isn't like flagging stuff up as important, because you're just used to doing it.
Exactly.
Having said that, when I used to do data entry, that was the longest, most boring, tedious job I've ever done. But I suppose what was nothing interesting about that. But what was different about that was that it would be like, you would look at a piece of, you would get like a form, and it would have someone's address and their postcode in it, and they'd all be different. And obviously, like individual addresses and postcodes, and you would have to, it would be handwritten, and you'd have to make out the handwriting and put it into a database, and you'd have to fill in all of the bits, and then you'd put it on, you take it from the left side, you put it on the right side on the pile over there, and then you'd move on to the next one and set up another one, and you would do that Monday till Wednesday lunchtime, and then on Wednesday lunchtime your job changed to stuffing envelopes. And you do that Wednesday lunchtime to Friday. And you'd get to a point halfway through Tuesday where you could not fucking wait for Wednesday lunchtime. And then you'd get to Friday and you'd be like, I can't wait for fucking
Monday morning.
Death. Just death. Death. It was the worst job I ever had. I think you stink while I was doing that.
I think I remember you wrote the song about data entry as well.
I wrote my song about admin, but I wrote that remembering my job in admin.
Okay.
But it was a specific job that I had in Hatfield, not the one I had in St Albans with Assetware. They were nice people. The one in Hatfield was a fucking slog. But I wrote a musical there. I found, do you remember that we've got to play a song soon? In the olden days, when we first started doing shows, I found my first ever 20. It was for mostly comedy in Hitchin.
Oh yeah.
And they never paid much. I think I got travel or something like that. And as sort of a payment, they would give you like a DVD of your gig. And I found it the other day. I found like the first ever 20 that I did. And I've got it on my computer. And I used to have a joke. It was just like always about, it was all my stuff was about what I was up to at the time, and I was working in admin, and I had a joke where it was like, I've worked out that if you can make your browser on your computer the exact size of your head, that you can go on Facebook all day and your boss won't notice. I said, you've just got to stay really, really still.
Good job.
It was funny. It was really funny. Finish off talking about Renify. I feel like I bulldozed you a bit there.
No, I think that's it. I think it's great. I think it's I really like, it's one of those, like, it's a really nice premise, and then Matthew McConaughey shows up and he's this real sort of cartoonish character. But to me it just feels like it's one of those films that knows exactly what it is. It's quite silly, but in a real, like, it's quite bombastic. It's not ashamed of itself. And that's what I really like about it. It's got this thing, it's like this. It's like a sort of big action movie. It's not like, I mean, I don't mean it's like, I'm sort of doing it down to say it's a bit dumb, but it knows its own thing. It's sort of very self-aware.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun and knows it.
And it's got silly ideas in it, like them creating Star Wars and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah, it was sort of like when Matthew McConaughey, before he went into his rom-com period.
Exactly.
And it was him sort of like making interesting films.
Well, that was it. He came into the game, didn't he, via Joel Schumacher's Time to Kill. And it was almost like he was invented to be a star, wasn't he? It's like, we need a star for this film that's already loaded with other big names. It's got Samuel L. Jackson, Sandra Bullock, Kevin Spacey, Donald Sutherland. And so they bring in this guy who's like an unknown, and it's like, you know, who could we get to be this the lead in this big film? And it was like,
well, we'll get that guy. We'll get that guy with the paddle from Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, exactly.
No, he didn't have the paddle. He wasn't the paddler. That was Ben Affleck,
he
wasn't
was
it?
The older one, wasn't he? He's the older guy in Dazed and Confused. But that's like, that was one of those funny inventions. And Joel Schumacher tried to do exactly the same thing with Colin Farrell, didn't he, later? What was that film
called? Tigerland, wasn't it?
Tigerland.
That was Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg was like, I reckon Colin Farrell was going to be huge. And then everyone started casting him.
Yeah, and but it then, worked.
But that's what Spielberg does, doesn't he? He did it with Shia LaBeouf, where he was just like, no, he's going to be in the Transformers movies. He's going to be in Indiana Jones. Shia LaBeouf is going to be a big star. Take the paper bag off your head. Oh, no. And it's just like, you know, fame is bad for people, I think. What did I watch? I watched a film called Domino this week.
Is that Tony Scott?
No, not that one.
Oh.
It's Brian De Palma's film that he made in 2019.
Oh, I saw something about this. Is it terrible?
It's not terrible. It's weird because it's set in June or July 2020 and no one's wearing a face mask.
At least we know we're coming out of it then.
It lost me there. No one was social distancing or anything. It was set a year in the future. It's sort of about terrorism. It's sort of got quite a convoluted plot, and it's quite, I'd say it was sort of boring. It's weird because it's not like a fall from grace like Dario Argento, where he's made sort of like, because I think they're quite similar filmmakers as well, especially their 70s stuff.
Yeah,
it's all got like a dreamlike quality to it. I think it's for completists, but there are some.
I'm sort of on a bit of a Brian De Palma thing at the minute. I'm kind of into. I think I'm going to watch Domino in the next couple of weeks. Maybe we should.
I think it's worth watching. There are some like classic. It's like because I'm looking at it because I saw Obsession recently, and I think that is one of the best films I've seen in a long, long, long time. Right, and that was made in the early 70s. Mm. I think Obsession is incredible. But basically, Obsession was Brian De Palma saying, "I want to remake Vertigo. How do we remake Vertigo?" And so when you're watching it, I'm always sort of like. It's kind of like I've got this big gap in my memory. I think of Brian De Palma as kind of like Obsession and Blowout and Sisters and all of those 70s movies that he made. And then I leap to now. But in actual fact, I don't even think of Carlito's Way or Mission Impossible or Mission to Mars or Snake Eyes. You know, he made loads of films. He kept making films. This film is kind of like... It's not as bad as late Dario Argento. Dario Argento made this film called Giallo with Adrian Brody in it, and it is absolute fucking shit. It's like a fan-made budget tribute to some of the themes that Dario Argento used to be interested in by Dario Argento, and it's just really shit. But then he made the Dracula film as well, Dracula 3D.
No, I've never seen that either.
I think that it's not good, but it's fucking entertaining. It's got Rutger Hauer in it as Van Helsing, and it is so shit. But it's also sort of like it sort of like revels in it, not deliberately, but it sort of revels in how shit and crazy it is. Because it's just not a retelling of Dracula, really, but it's period. It's sort of an interesting film. But this Domino film... It's sort of like not a massive fall from grace. And you can see that Brian De Palma is obviously still trying to do stuff. He's like, the beginning is basically another rip-off of Vertigo, where he's just basically like going, I'm going to do a Vertigo thing. But it doesn't have any real repercussions later on in the film. But it's kind of like, you know, like how there's a rooftop chase and then he falls off the roof and you think, right, well, he's going to get like a fear of heights. That never comes back. At any point, it's like you're setting up a character trait at the beginning of the film, like they do in Vertigo, but it just doesn't have any repercussions. So there are like Brian De Palma-esque moments within the film that he's really tried to do, but it's kind of like got that digital film kind of quality to it where it just all feels a little bit cheap and but it's kind of like, it's a quite a boring pedestrian film that has obviously been made by a guy that's really trying to sort of add his value to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen like a couple of things recently that he did a film, I think called Redacted as well, that's apparently quite good. So I think I might just try and go through watching all of them again over the next few months.
It doesn't feel like he didn't turn up for work. It feels like the script just wasn't strong enough and it wasn't an interesting enough film.
Yeah, he's trying. He hasn't got a lot of money. He hasn't got perhaps a great script, but he's still trying to go, well, I'm still Brian De Palma. I'm still going to make the best film I can, given the circumstances.
Yeah. It's got Guy Pearce in it.
Okay.
There's one bit when Guy Pearce is having dinner in his house with this terrorist. And Guy Pearce is eating dinner. And it's like, you know, when you're distracted with how bad the food acting is.
Right, yes.
He spends the whole meal sawing up this one slice of tomato on his plate. And it's on his fork. And then they cut away for when he actually puts it in his mouth. And when they cut back to him, he's chewing. And it's just sort of like, you don't listen to anything that they're saying because you're just looking at how much of an effort. It's like when I used to watch King of Queens or Everybody Loves Raymond. And they'd have a sandwich. And they'd go in and they'd act like they were taking this huge bite and then they'd nibble it. And then now they're talking, they're like chewing and like really, but you're like going, you've taken nothing out of that sandwich. It's like a tiny little crescent. You've taken like a toenail clipping out of that fucking sandwich. Just sort of like really like acting your fucking ass off, like eating this fucking sandwich. So it's a bit like that, but it's Guy Pearce doing it. So it's just kind of like you're going, oh my God, how delicious is that tomato? You think, you're making a meal of that? stuff like that.
Hey, I think Gene Hackman never eats on screen or stopped eating on screen for that reason, where he says, I've never seen a convincing performance of someone eating. So if it's in the script, he says, can we not have this? I think like he made a point of trying to cut that out of films he's in, because every time he'd watch it back, he'd sort of see the sort of self-conscious himself eating or something. And he says, yeah. I just can't do it. You just can't do it properly. So you I
had to eat quite a lot when we did Uncle. And on the first take, I would always just get this sandwich and I would just smash it into my face, right? And then you'd have to do like 10 takes. And I'd be like, oh God. And they'd be like, we're breaking for lunch. And I'd be like, I'm lying down. I'm having to lie down. And there was a party scene in the first series where I go along the entire party, all of the party snacks, and I'd get one thing from every bowl. And I just did it randomly. And then I had to remember what order I did it in for every single take. And it was, I spent the whole time just sort of like trying to remember, when do I eat the breadstick and when do I eat the sausage roll and all of that stuff. So, food is quite difficult. But Brad Pitt does it. He eats in every film, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that's one of his things. Yeah, he loves it.
That's his I'll be back. He puts it in every film where he's just sort of like eating. Yeah.
Should we do some fan mail?
Right. Let's do some fan mail. Natalie, play that funky music, bad girl. Hi, Nick and Nat. Hope you're both safe and well. This week, technically, it was last week, but after we recorded the show.
I have to go. Technically, it was last week, but after.
Sorry. Oh. From the top, cue the music.
Right.
Hi, Nick and Nat. Hope you're both safe and well this week. Hi, Nick and Nat. Hope you're... reset the music. Okay. And maestro, say those sweet, sweet words. Okay. Hi, Nick and Nat. Hope you're both safe and well this week.
Technically, it was last week, but after you recorded the show.
I have been a fan of Nick and Matt's Film Club. where we all got to look at our phones whilst Cool Runnings was on in the background. It was really fun, and I hope there will be more to come. Thank you for continuing to provide us with five-star content.
Emma, P.S. I have told my friends.
Well, thanks, Emma.
We did that last week.
We watched Cool Runnings together. Well, we didn't, did we?
No, we're separately. We watched it separately in our own houses.
Didn't watch any of it. I spent the whole time staring at my phone.
Yeah.
But what I think we could do is we could do it on Zoom. And we could watch the film and then people could follow us at home. And we could almost do sort of like a live commentary while we're doing it. We're not doing it this week, but I think we should do it next week.
Yeah, we'll probably do another film next week. If people want to join in, we'll figure that out. We'll put something on our respective social medias and do something with that.
If anyone's listening and thinks they can help us work out how to do it, then let us know. Afternoon!
Or evening. Don't know what time it is where you are. And what even is time anymore?
Good point.
I love the show, and I love you fuzzy bears. I like to pop you in my ears, crack open a tinny, and enjoy 2 hours of afternoon delights while I'm listening to you. That sounds like you're... Oh, no. Oh. What do you like to do of an afternoon? Pretty much sounds like I like doing what you're doing. Have a sizzling Friday, my cherubs. Tony. What do you like doing in the afternoon now?
Well, on a Friday afternoon, I'm usually doing fan club. which is...
No, you're not.
In fact, we're not now. What do I do on Fridays? I do therapy.
Are you still doing it? Are you still doing
it? Yeah, doing it over Skype.
How are you finding?
Bit weird, but it's all right. I've actually weirdly got used to it very quickly. Mm. Very quickly.
Mm. Yeah, I've stopped doing therapy while we're in lockdown, and I'm all right with it at the moment. I think I'm fine. I do believe in therapy a lot. I think it's really good, but also I do feel like it can be there when you need it rather than as a regular thing. I went through, like, I did a lot of processing over an amount of time, and then I felt like I was trying to come up with things to talk about, and then I felt like I was dredging stuff up that I didn't really need to dredge up.
Yeah.
And I was actually feeling really bad about all the stuff that I was feeling. And then when I stopped doing therapy for a little bit, those things sort of settled down, and then the more important things sort of floated to the surface. And I can kind of deal with that now. And I think therapy has given me the tools with which to deal with stuff and to give me some perspective. And I know it's there when I need it, but actually I'm in a better place than I was. But well done, Nat.
Yeah, and would you think you'll start again when you're out of lockdown?
I might do. I don't feel like I need it right now.
Okay.
But I think that I wouldn't be in this position if I hadn't been to therapy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It would be. Therapy has absolutely helped, and right now I've got the tools that I need in order to look after myself. And when I need to go back to therapy, I haven't got the stigma and I'm not worried about going back. I can kind of just do it whenever I need. Okay. All right. I was thinking of putting in a wash on. It will mainly consist of my duvet cover and pillows. Should I iron them before I slink them back onto my bed? I never have done it, but I've got time on my hands now. Will.
Seems like a waste. I wouldn't bother.
I won't bother. I mean, duvet cases are just absolutely horrific to iron. yeah, but good for you for washing your duvet. I have to say, I only do mine when, you know, it's an emergency. Yeah, when it takes a lot of effort to just fold it off. There's sort of like...
You'd want four arms.
It's just, you know, when you get into bed and all you can hear is crackling. That's when you need to change your duvet case. It's these times of COVID If I wasn't at home, I wouldn't. Anyway. Hello, Nick and Nat. You are one of the best. We're two of the best, I think you'll find. I've been trying to learn how to sew during this lockdown and failing miserably. Have you learnt any new skills? Dimitri. Well, I've learned how to do accents. How about you? Regional accents. That's my skill. How about you, Nathaniel?
I'm not sure I've learned anything whatsoever. I'll have a think about that and tell you next week. God, that's a sad thing. That's a sad thing.
Lastly this week, hey, I'm thinking of nipping to the post office, but not sure what time it shuts. Do you have any idea, Stan?
About 5 o'clock, isn't it?
Usually about five.
Five.
I get there maybe half four, just in the safe side.
Just in case there's a queue, but you should be all right if you get there before five. And I know that you asked that question to be a little bit of a time-wasting, pathetic cunt, Stan, but the joke's on you, because we did actually have an answer. I think sometimes it's seven, actually, on a weekday. Maybe it's 8 o'clock on a Wednesday and a Saturday.
On a Saturday, Stan, it might shut about two in the afternoon.
Yeah, bet you feel like a right proper cunt now, don't you, Stan? Go fuck yourself. That's the fan mail for this week. Thanks, guys. Keep writing in.
Let's play this.
Some people live for the fortune. Some people live for the fame. Some people live for the power. Some people live just to play the game. Some people think that the physical things define what's within. A boy so full of the superficial. Some people want it all, I don't want nothing at all. If it ain't you, baby, if I ain't got you, baby. Some people want diamond rings, some just want never mind fine. Everything means nothing if I ain't. Search for the fountain, promises forever young. Some people need 3 dozen roses. That's the only way you'll ever prove you love them. Hand me the world and a silver platter, and what's good would it be with no one to share and no one who truly cares for me? Some people want it all, I don't want nothing at all. If it ain't you, baby, if I ain't got you, baby. Some people want if I ain't got you, yeah. I can't imagine life without you. I can't, no, I can't, no, I can't imagine life. everything means nothing if I ain't by you.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
So, right, we're back in the studio. We're not in the studio. We are in our bedrooms and living rooms. Direct from Las Vegas, we are joined by singing sensation Matt Goss. Hello.
Hello, my friend. How are you? Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and whatever time it is. I don't really know.
Good morning. How are you doing? Are you all right?
I am actually, yeah. It's like everybody else. It's a little bit like Groundhog Day at times, but it's all trying to do our thing, I think, really just to stay motivated and stay connected to this thing. Well, I certainly am. I just want to do as much as I can. And I've been a bit lonely at times, not going to lie, but it's definitely humbling, you know.
So are you there by yourself? Are you in lockdown by yourself?
Yeah, I am. I have a little French bulldog, which he's basically in everything that is valuable. He's just eating. So I may well come out of this absolutely nothing, but it's just me and a French bulldog. My French bulldog, Reggie.
Yeah.
Where do you get the name Reggie from?
After Reggie Craig. He was one of my old mates, and we used to speak.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we used to speak a lot. Reggie used to call me from prison. Or he would say, calling from Her Majesty's. And he used to read poetry, and we used to chat. And it was just an incredible friendship we started to build. And, so that's why I named after Reggie.
How did you two connect?
How did that happen?
It was a strange one, really, because I was having a sitting down at a sushi restaurant, and I'll never forget it. I was like, hello. Phone call, and he was like, hello, Matt. I was like, yeah. He was like, it's Reggie. I went, Reggie Cray. I'm like, hello, how you doing, Reggie? And it was just one of those moments. We just got on. He read my book. He was a very interesting man, and he was full of things that he wanted to do. You remember, he did serve 30 years. He did his time, and he wanted to be a clothing designer. He wanted to, you know, he had so many things that he wanted to do. He sent me sketches of the designs he wanted to do. Just an incredibly interesting person. And obviously both being twins, and we just had a sense of being. I went to visit him in Her Majesty's, and he was just a very, very nice man.
So he knew of you from prison and was aware of you, and I guess sort of felt a kinship or something, or saw you as like, yeah, another set of twins or something, or...
Yeah, I think so. He said he felt he understood the dynamic of being a twin, and he understood the dynamic of wanting your own identity. I think that was where it came from, really. Like, when you're a twin, you pine for, possibly overcompensate for your own identity being a twin, because people think if you break your wrist, your brother's going to break his wrist. It's right. Really, people think you are literally the same person sometimes, but it's that's not the case.
Yeah.
We're very, very different people.
If I slapped you, your brother would feel it.
And that sounds not really. Kinky. That sounds a little kinky to me, bro. I think you've been in lockdown too long.
Yeah, I have.
I think you're hearing on me.
far away. So, far away.
Or maybe my brother, even weirder, maybe just hit on Luke subconsciously, you know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah.
I'll let him know. I'll let him know later.
Okay, sure. Oh, brilliant. Oh, great. I've scored. That's fantastic. Tell us about this single that you're releasing. It's out now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's available on all digital platforms, but it was meant to be my first single off the new album, and I was lucky enough to record it with one of my dear friends, Babyface Kenny, and I think he's one of the greatest soul producers in the world. And we were meant to release it with all the bells and whistles. But I just said to him, why are we waiting during this time? Why would we just not try and get involved? And when I'd see all this footage of the NHS, and it was just, it's so poignant, and it makes me so homesick, and it just makes me want to get stuck in and try and help in some way. it was heart-wrenching for me to see people suffering, and also it's so inspiring to see our Earth Angels, the NHS, walk towards danger, knowing that they could possibly be in harm's way. I spoke to many. I go live on my Instagram at 9 p.m. every day, UK time, and I spoke to a lot of nurses and doctors yesterday, and they were telling me, you know, that they've all had it. They all got it and got through it and went straight back to work and continued to crack on with helping people. And for me, it was not really about a single. Listen, I'm really proud of the song, and I've never heard a man sing it before. And I play it in my show here in Las Vegas. The show would have been 11 years in this June. And I always get an incredible reaction, a standing ovation for that song. And Babyface came by the show and he said, let's record it. And so we recorded it and it turned out really well.
Because it's an Alicia Keys cover, right?
Absolutely, yeah. 2003, though, it's back further than you realize.
Yeah. I guess it's become its own standard now.
Yeah, it is. It's a soul classic, and that's why you always have to think twice before taking on a song like that. But I was in safe hands, and I was proud of my performance on the record. And it's just really, it's just everything means nothing without the NHS. It just kind of makes sense, and you put it with the images, and also, to be honest with you, being one of the lads at the show. I always see the fellas always say, thank you for singing music that connects to us as well as fellas. And so really it's a baby making record. So I'm hoping that this record will be used for making future generations, fellas. So,
I'm on my own at the moment. So
there's a lot of self-love involved. You can still make
stuff. I'm probably so doing more harm than good.
So there's a lot of self-love on this call right now, I feel, but we can live vicariously through the thought of people making love to my record. That's a bit weird as well.
Well, if I make love to your record to myself, will Luke feel it?
I think Luke will feel it. I'll feel uncomfortable, but he'll definitely feel it.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. It's
a win-win, mate. It's a win-win. It is.
You're going to be godfather to lots of kids in 9 months.
Yeah, they're going to have like long hair, like a 70s porno moustache with blue eyes.
Do you think there's going to be a population spike when in 9 months' time? There's going to be like two spikes. There's going to be like a spike while we're in lockdown, and there's also going to be a spike like the day that we're all out of lockdown.
I think there has been a lot of shagging going on in the beginning when people weren't driving each other crazy.
Right.
And now I think there could be a lot of single parents after this whole thing. That's what I honestly think. I don't know about you, but I'm not really, I can't even think about like the thought of going out, and I feel even more antisocial than I did before. I'm not really looking forward to the madness. I think we've all gone a little bit like a lot of people I know have felt a little bit more connected to, the people that they want to be around. And I know somebody said to me the other day, they're going to have a party. My friend of mine actually is going to have a party, a dinner party where they bring their own food and their own wine. I'm like, that does not sound like a good time to me. Does it?
I'm quite happy sitting in, to be honest. I don't mind. I don't really want to go out. I want to kind of do as little as possible that's going to have any effect on spreading anything. I just want to be...
I agree. And I don't have any desire, really, to go out there and suddenly find, somebody to make a baby with. I just, make love, make a baby, or even, it's a lot easier. It's like, the good thing about living by yourself, you can play video games whenever you want and watch whatever you want. And I do think there's going to be a bit of a spike in the old population. I think a lot of people would probably go into town at the very beginning of this thing.
So you're currently in Las Vegas, and and it's 8:30 in the morning there. So you've just got up. It's the beginning of your day.
Talk about Las Vegas, but I don't think we said that the proceeds to your single are going towards NHS, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, if you go to just giving.com, and then type in my name, Matt Goss, M-A-T-T-G-O-S-S. You can just give anything you want, whether it be a quid or a million quid. It all helps. So.
To be
really easy, just go to my Instagram. Just go to my Instagram, Matt Goss, and there's the link is in my bio. It takes you straight to the page.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, and your aim is at the moment on your Just Giving page, you're aiming to get 50,000, don't you? 50 grand.
Yeah, we've got enough for we've got enough. It's about a quid a meal, so we've got about 13,000 meals. And to be honest with you, I want to keep doing this even after we're through this.
Yeah, of course.
Just have a page where people can know that there's a place. The fellow that's doing Andrew, that he's actually put 9,000 miles on his car, and he's just driving around and giving out food. And he's got a restaurant, and he's just chosen to do it all for cost. He's not making a penny out of this, so he really is grateful for anything, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well done.
The smaller charities are the ones that need help, because they have there's no stockpile of cash. It's just literally day by day whether they can continue or not. So it's kind of insane to see the reactions of the nurses and the ambulance drivers. The ambulance drivers are really kind of being left out in a way, because they really are lonely and they really are isolated, and it's a quite an intense thing to witness, the conversation between those guys.
Yeah, bad. Where are you based usually, Matt?
I have a place in the UK. I have a place in LA, but where I reside really is Las Vegas. It's definitely for me. It's definitely a very much more peaceful place. I'll show you my view. That's my view there.
Wow! Oh my God! You live on a golf course.
I live on a golf course, mate. Hey, look, here you go.
You live on a golf course. Oh my God. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you've had a residency in Las Vegas for, you were saying, 11 years?
It'll be 11 years in June, yeah. And I'm still at the Mirage right now. But who knows, when we come out of this, I might be at a different casino. But I did 7 years at Caesar's Palace, which was amazing. Amazing memories there.
Yeah.
So can you just talk us through you transitioning from Bros into being a solo artist?
Well, it was, the thing is, being a front man is that you just still get on stage and sing, you know. I mean, it was a shock to me, to be honest with you. I still don't think that we should have split up back then. I think we should have hung in there. And even though the press were being, it was no other word than evil to us, it was because we lost a load of money at the time, and it was just, it was an extreme experience, like nothing I've, to this day, I've ever experienced. But my brother just had simply had enough. He just, I've had enough of this. It's just music. It shouldn't be about, if we lose our money, that's our problem, you know what I mean? And there was no social media back then, so we were constantly on our back foot. It's not like now where you can go online and say, nah, that was bollocks. It didn't happen that way.
Defend yourself. But also, you can reach out to your fan base and get support that way, can't you?
Yeah, but not even about support. You can put the record straight. You can say, this is what was said and this is why. Listen, you know, we were represented by sound bites. You know, when you went back then, you were just, if there was a sound bite or there was a headline, that was your life for the next, until the next interview. And now that you've kind of eradicated the middleman, so you can go directly to the public, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. It makes journalism a lot more responsible. But after that, after Bros, I went to LA and I started to make a record. And I was, within a year, I was in the record plant in LA, one of the most famous studios in the world, still one of my favorite studios in the world, and Conway Studios on Melrose in Hollywood. Just such amazing studios, in my mind, two of the best studios in the world. And I just started to make a record called The Key. And in my world, that's one of the favorite albums of my fans. And it was a great record, but it was still a strange thing. Really, I remember also within a couple of years, I was on stage at Carnegie Hall with the Tokyo String Quartet and in New York. And I think it's about getting up, getting ready, and staying on the pitch, because there's plenty of other people that want to get on the pitch and play. And it's hard sometimes, because even now, like with the show, I started to cut back some of the shows because it didn't feel like my voice anymore. It felt like it started to feel really like work and hard work, physical, because singing is very physical for 2 hours, almost 2 hours a show, an hour and 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. But what happened was I wrote a song called Evil, and I was doing the video, and then Michael Greco said to me, he saw the video and he said to one of my team, he says, I want him at our casino. It's at the Palms. A gentleman called George Maloof. The Maloof family are very famous in Vegas. They were the only private owners of a casino in Vegas at the time. And they asked, can you come to Vegas tomorrow and for a meeting so we can meet you? And I'm like, okay. So I went to Vegas the next day, and a brilliant meeting. You know, casino, all the brothers, the Maloof brothers, and we were all sitting there, and we had a great meeting. I left 2 days later, hadn't heard anything. Michael Greco called me and said, he says, don't worry. He said, we're going to make this happen. We really want you here. And I said, if I'm not at that casino, I'm going to take that Audemars Piguet watch from you. And he goes, I know you will. He said, I know, because we had an agreement. He'd give me his watch if I didn't get the show. And anyway, the next day he called me up and he said, I've got good news and I've got bad news. And I said, give me the bad news. And he went, you're not getting my watch. Welcome to Las Vegas. And and then within 9 months of being at the Palms, Caesars Palace came, Gary Celestina, the president of Caesars, still one of my dear friends, came in and said, do you want to meet me for lunch tomorrow at the noodle bar at Caesars? We sat down over noodles and he said, do you want a beer? I said, I really do. And he goes, should we do this? And I said, yeah. We shook hands. And that night, his whole team was meant to be coming to my show to quote unquote review the show. And the director of entertainment said, I understand you and the boss said, I've already done the deal. I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'll just sit back and enjoy the show then. So it was a good experience. Vegas has been some incredible experience. So we used to go and sit on the roof at Caesars where Hangover was filmed. And we used to just watch the strip and watch people in the clubs and with a bottle of scotch and just have a chat. It was good.
When you play somewhere like Caesar's Palace, do you feel the history of it? Do you kind of feel the responsibility and the hugeness of it?
Yeah, I without question, you feel the heritage, and you see the pictures of Sinatra and you see the pictures of Muhammad Ali that fought there, because that's where the big fights used to be. Evel Knievel, when Evel Knievel jumped over the...
That's right. Over the,
you know, just all those pictures that you see when you walk through the corridors. They're like any other corporate, terrible corridors, you know, bad lighting, but you have these incredible pictures of Muhammad Ali, the Rat Pack, Sinatra. I was lucky enough to actually, I may have been one of the last people to ever sing for Muhammad Ali. I went to Ali's house. That's one of my favorites. I went there with my dear friend Bernie Human and Larry Ruvo, and we got on Larry's jet and we flew and to Ali's house, and I had breakfast and lunch with him at his house. And I've met some incredible people because of singing. You know, it's taken me all over the world.
When you're going on at Caesar's Palace, does it also feel like, do you feel a responsibility as well? Do you feel like the show has to be big, and or do you feel like it's any other gig and you just do your show?
Well, to be honest with you, that's a broad, it has to be a broad answer for me, because my mum always used to say that I sing like I'm getting $1 million a song. I don't think, if you do not undress your soul, then how do you expect the audience to believe you? And I think that you have to undress yourself in order to get to the truth of singing. Singing is a very, very, is meant to be a painful, joyful and joyful experience. It's meant to, you're meant to go to a place, you have to remember why you wrote certain lyrics, and you also have to connect to songs that you didn't write. And I think for me, obviously, I definitely felt the presence of being also at the Mirage, you know, the Mirage, you know, Siegfried and Roy with just, you know, unfortunately we just lost Roy. But any casino on the strip, you do have a sense of heritage. You know, they actually awarded me with Matt Goss Day, August 8th. And in Las Vegas, and they didn't know it was my mum's birthday, and so So it was, I went and they gave me key to the strip, and it just incredible things have happened here. So I owe a great deal to this town.
Do you feel that? Because it's that you are a success by anyone's measure. That you've done it in the UK in Bross, you go to America. I don't know, were Bross big in the States, or were you going there virtually as an unknown?
Nobody had a clue I was in Vegas when I came here. Nobody had a clue.
But you've gone to the States, so you've basically started from the bottom again, and you've built yourself up to be playing Caesar's Palace. Do you feel then that there's, like you're talking about the NHS as being like the best of the UK. Do you feel like the press in the UK are kind of like the worst part of it then?
First of all, I just have to say I'm at the Mirage now, currently, but which is next door to Caesars. But I think that the press back then were nothing short of appalling. Nothing short of appalling. But now I have to say my relationship with the press is completely different. I mean, my relationship with the press has been different with than my brothers, I think, in some ways, because I have continuously come back. I have played, you know, many nights at the Royal Albert Hall and even more at the Palladium and Wembley. I got best show of 2016 as a solo artist at Wembley. So I still, you know, when I get that award downstairs from Wembley Arena to think about all the bands that played that year at Wembley, I won the best show of the year. And to me, it's going to sound corny, but I have a thing. So you have to, it's just left foot, right foot. When you go through life, you have to put left foot in front of the right foot. Sometimes it feels really difficult, but you have to remember to dance along the way. You have to dance along the way, because there are days where you just go, I don't really want to do this anymore. And it's a really strange feeling, because after 32 years, there are days where the only thing that gets you on stage is that audience. And you know, and I don't matter. It doesn't matter what field you're in with what you guys do, with what we're going through now. It's a lot of output. You understand this? It's a lot of output. And sometimes, certainly with what you guys do, you don't even get a live audience in front of you. So there is people do not understand. Sometimes there's a lot of output to entertainment, quote unquote.
So. Here's a question. So you've got a residency in Las Vegas, and I think like Aerosmith had a residency in Las Vegas, and you've got Siegfried and Roy. Are you sort of like, is there sort of like a circuit of performers in Las Vegas that have got residencies, and then you all go to a bar afterwards and go and compare notes on how your shows went?
I think that there's, unfortunately, I would, first of all, there are places that entertainers go to, and I'll just give a little shout out to Naked Fish Sushi, which is a little hole in the wall sushi place, which is way off the strip. But I think the truth be told is that when you do your show, I live off of the strip about 17 minutes to be exact, because I literally drive to the show, I get out of my car, the valet, shake the hands, have a good show, Matt. Cheers. Walk in. We do a hands in family. I go on stage, do my show, meet and greet, tons of hugs, selfies, stories, get back in my car. And I use that 17 minute drive home to depressurize. And sometimes I'll go to my sushi spot and there'll be other entertainers there and stuff like that. But we tend to not talk about our shows. We tend not to talk about, it's almost like, oh, you also don't want to have music on in the car after the show. You need that silence. You need the solitude a little bit. But yeah, there's some brilliant, brilliant people here. Very profound people in Vegas. You know, I've had all kinds of people come. Jason Statham come to my show. Sharon Stone. You know, unbelievable. Dick Clark. Incredible people have come to the show. You know, extraordinary.
Right.
Even Ricky Hatton got up and sang or tried to sing. He was a good laugh. We've had the one thing about Vegas is that whatever you think you know about the music industry, burn it. Burn it and then burn it again. It has nothing to do with the music industry, because you are performing to people that may have read a review. And they're like, oh, bird, you know. And then they're sitting there like, entertain me. I want to see if the review is true. And then obviously half the room, two-thirds of the room knows you, but one-third of that room may absolutely have no idea who you are. Yeah. Every night.
Yeah, well, me and Nat are stand-up comedians, and I used to get people coming in to see me based on reviews, and they would always walk out. hate me.
But you know what I mean then? It's like people do, literally, they'll base their night out on a TripAdvisor review. Certain tourists, and it's, and to you, you're, you know, all joking aside, you as a comedian, you are putting material together based on what's deep within you, and like, and your sensibility as a comedian. It's like, you know, there's an art to that. That's something that I have so much respect for. That's a very difficult thing.
Yeah, but it's the same thing you were saying about, like, yeah, if people are looking, like, going to see a base in a review or something, they're not, they'll go, oh, that's got, but it's usually just stars as well. They've gone, that's got 4 or 5 stars, I'll go and see that one. But it doesn't have anything to do with whether they'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. So I'll go to the four-star funny guy.
Yeah.
And it's, but it's sort of like, I always think of it, I did a gig 10 years ago called Big Value Comedy, and people would pay like £5 and they'd go and see 3 comedians. And you go, yeah, but what sort of comedy is it? And that's like going to sort of like, hey, I'm going to a music night. And then you go to the music night and it's jazz. And you go, oh, I don't like jazz. And it's just like, well, no one said it was going to be your sort of music.
But it's even more obscure to say what kind of comedy. It's like, well, it's really unfunny comedy, you should check it out, you know.
Yeah, that's what I do.
We're trying a new style of comedy that it's actually mime, everything's mime.
I mean, there is that does exist.
It does, exactly. Well, it sounds pretty, yeah, well, that's the kind of thing I would go to the 2-star review just for shits and giggles.
Well, that's my show then.
do you find being in Las Vegas? I know when I went, I think I only stayed for like probably overnight, so it's like 12 hours. But definitely at the moment, because we're all in lockdown, it's just really difficult to sort of place what time of day it is. And I just find that in Las Vegas, especially when you're in all the casinos, they sort of like, they plan them so that you never know what time of day it is.
Yeah. The lighting inside the casino with the lighted ceilings and the clouds, and it's all based on. But I think, you know, I wrote a song called "Lovely Las Vegas," which I actually amazing story, but I can't actually won't go into the story. But anyway, I wrote this song.
Great, you're a wonderful guest.
thank you very much. Good night. I think there is a lot more about this town that people don't know. And after having a show for over a decade, you know, the restaurants, the entertainment, the countryside around here, like if you come here, you've got to go to Red Rock Canyon. And you've got to, you know, you've got to rent a convertible and drive around the Red Rock Canyon loop. And it's just God's country. It's like unbelievable, the vistas and just the... It's an incredible town. It's a much more diverse town than people think. And, you know, I do think that this town, we do have to be very careful. We are dependent upon, by definition, we are dependent upon crowds. And not only crowds from all over the world. So 40 million people come through here. So we want to get it right. And that's why I'm glad the governor's being strong and he's holding his ground. But because this town is a remarkable place, and I'm proud to have been part of this town for a long time. And I really want, you know, I do want people to give it a bit of a thought for the entertainers and the comedians and the any performing arts. We are purely solely dependent upon on crowds and to do what we do. And they're alive. There are virtual concerts and all that stuff, and I think it's very innovative and exciting, but it does not pay the bills for the average entertainer. It doesn't. And we will be on our knees if there are not intelligent stimulus packages and stuff like that put in place by governments, and I mean real soon, because, you know, the payrolls and stuff like that are like devastating and financially. So I think that, you know, not to bring a downer, but I do think it's important to try and urge governments to also just not think that entertainers or famous people or DJs or have a rainbow with a magic pot of gold at the end of it. That's the perception. It's not the reality.
Exactly. I think there's this thing now as well that everyone's in lockdown. What people are consuming now is entertainment that has been made for them. So that's how they get through the day. and they've almost got to think about all this stuff was provided by people. That's all like yeah. the drama that's been made before, or it's you know, like songs that are listening to or films that have been made. That's what's getting built through the day. And I think people do have to think about that afterwards, that this is currently, it's creative people that are getting everyone through the lockdown.
As always, as they always do, yeah.
Yeah.
And I also think there's also a little bit of somewhat a sense of shame to say that, you know, to think that you want to earn money or you want, but the reality is that's, you know, I would like to take that veil off, you know, and just be like, that's not the way it is. And I think that, you know, there is a tremendous amount of output that goes into that. And, you know, I just really want to make sure that artists and entertainers and anyone in performing arts are taken care of, because I mean, everything is shut down. I mean, our industry will probably end up being the last one to open, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think that's it. You
know, we're being told that comedy clubs aren't going to open until next year now. And it's kind of like, well, you know, aside from doing bits of telly, that is our income. You know, I'm meant to be on tour at the moment, and we actually delayed it. But because everyone's tours have been delayed, there's sort of like a backlog. So my tour has been delayed by an entire year. So it's kind of like, obviously, I make money off of the tour, but I've got to wait a year before I can actually start making that money. So it's all,
But that's the thing, like, who do you know? Who do you know that, like, there are very, very few people that can actually just go, oh, just wait this out for a year.
Yeah.
It's, that's where I'm at. I'm like, okay, right now we're doing this. It's amazing when, you know, listen, I like Boris, and I think he's actually, you know, I think there's elements of him that I like, certainly elements that I like. But when I hear things like "Stay Alert," and I'm just like, for what? You know. Last time I checked, it was invisible, but it was "Stay Alert." It sounds very Churchillian, doesn't it? It's like very "Stay Alert," and we're like, all right, can you give us the magic Corona goggles so we can actually see what we're staying alert for, please? And it's, I think that to your point, it's like, we can stay alert, but we've also got, there's millions and millions of people that are self-employed people that are not going to be able to go to have any work. You know, I'm self-employed. Everybody I know is self-employed. It's mm-hmm. definitely going to be a scary time if it does, as you say, I think you're right, for another year.
Mm. I mean, I'm...
And it's not just, but also on top of that, it's not just, we're allowed to do gigs again. It's whether people even want to go to gigs,
whether I feel safe enough to be in front of a bunch of people as well. It's this, you know, this circle of eight, you know, it's a figure of eight. It's this, you know, mutual respect, but also, hey, are we all good here? Like, there's such a lack of information.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not a fan of Boris, and I feel that that is part of it, that we just don't have, like, the correct information. The information changes, not necessarily based on, like, new information. It's changing because of what they can do. And that's what I did at the minute. It's like reacting to things that they're not doing.
Yeah, well, I when I say I'm a fan, I like straight shooters, and I'm a huge fan of Churchill, and I really am. I'm, like, obsessed. I've just written me and Stephen Enderman just wrote the musical for Upstairs Downstairs. So
yeah, we saw that.
Yeah, we've inserted him into the story, but I like straight shooters, and I like that sense of stoic, you know, British pride. But ironically, I think it's divided us. You know, Scotland's on lockdown and we're not. I'm like, I think it's divided us even more. And I think the intention was good. And I think the intention is good to tell people to stay alert. But the working man has still got to go out there on the front lines and, quote unquote, keep the country going at his own peril. And it's we need more information. I do think it comes down to intelligent stimulus packages for people to actually be able to construct their lives. You know, the lenders, the banks, they should, all mortgages should be on hold if we're being asked to stay at home. All tenants and rent payments should be... It should be frozen. If they're saying stay at home, then they should have to they should make stimulus packages that allow us to stay at home without the fear of coming out of this, you know, and try and play and catch up for the last year. That's not the way economy's going to bounce back. The banks and the lenders have to dig in with communities. They really do. And I don't know how you guys feel about that, but
I think the same, because it's like if they were in trouble, it would be up to us to bail them out, which has happened before, happened 10 years ago. It was up to the taxpayers and things to then bail out the banks. So it's now the shoe's on the other foot. So it's now for them to help us out.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody's, I spoke to a builder the other day on one of my lives, and please, if you check it, if you can, come onto my live Instagrams at 9 p.m. because we have very diverse conversations. And there was a builder, he was a 65-year-old builder, and he was like, Matt, he said, I just don't know what I'm going to do. He says, you know, it's just me, myself, and I. And he said, I subcontract plumbers, I subcontract drywall guys. He said, I'm a builder. And he said, I subcontract everybody. And so we gave a shout out to his company and said, please use small businesses. If you need anything done during these times, use the small guys, because they are literally paycheck to paycheck. And it's heartbreaking to me. And it amazes me that government thinks that the general public, I think I read one quarter of the British public don't have any savings. So what's happened? What's going to happen? It's like, it's very robotic, and it's not very soulful. It doesn't take into account that people are literally building the anxiety, building right now at the thought of coming out of this, because all the switches are going to get put back on. And that's quite a frightening thing for a lot of people. And I worry about that. And I think that if the powers that be could say, you know, to the lenders and to the banks, everything is frozen until we're out of this, there's not everything. So the landlords don't have to worry because their mortgages are on hold, and the tenants don't have to worry. I think that would be a start to allow people to stop worrying about the immediacy of a roof over their head. I think that is the most obvious thing to me. But anyway, sorry if I'm getting it, if it's not very funny, but it's how I feel.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking then about this, you're writing an upstairs downstairs musical. So is that something you're a fan of then in the 70s, the TV show?
Well, I think I was a fan of always wanting to do something that allowed me to be the creator of something that I could also sit back and watch. And my friend Stephen Edelman, he'll tell you the same story. He used to call me, like, he started calling me about, you know, what do you think about this song? And it was like, I'm like, it's okay. And I was like, maybe it's a bit rigid, and, you know, and if it wanted to appeal to a new audience. And he called me on about the 10th call. I'm like, don't fucking call me anymore, because I'm contributing. And unless you're going to offer me a job, I love you, you're my buddy, I said, but don't call me anymore. And about this. And then he called me the next day. He said, were you serious about possibly contributing, like being involved in this? I said, yeah, of course. He said, he fired the whole Broadway team. And we got together and we agreed, we did the contracts and all that stuff, and we incorporated ourselves, and we set forth on a journey for 2 years every day on Skype calls. And we've written this and in person at times, but we wrote the most beautiful musical. We wrote 44 songs. We're currently getting the book finished. We have an incredible Broadway producer who's had massive hits there, and I can't say who yet, but I'm very, very proud of it. It's probably on a cerebral level, it's probably the most challenging thing I've done, because it's all set in 1914. So we let a lot of the history do all the heavy lifting for us in regards to the story, but we have inserted characters, one of them being Churchill.
Okay.
All the characters like Mrs. Bridges, Hudson, you know, Lord Bellamy, all those characters obviously still in there.
So is that a property that's known in the States then? So if you're going to try so it's all well known. Okay.
Yeah, it's known globally, yeah.
Wow. But also with sort of like successes like Downton Abbey and stuff, there's kind of like that British kind of aristocracy, that sort of like way of life
it's a class distinction. Upstairs downstairs was definitely about the upstairs and downstairs, you know, the service. the service industry being downstairs, which was very, and then obviously the wealthy, and there's a song called Underneath the Watch Face that we wrote, that was the workings, you know, the serene tabletop of the dinner party, which is the watch face. And underneath the watch face was all the service and the care of the house. And back then, it was a real privilege to be in the service industry, in an affluent house in Eaton Place. So it was genuinely a you know, you think I was joking when I said upstairs, downstairs, but it literally was that simple.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, like, if you think of yourself then now, and you're in Las Vegas a couple of years ago, what was the thing that you're sort of at the top of your game, and your brother then was in movies and things, so both of you are really successful. What was the thing that made you want to do Bros again?
I think it was really bad decision not to do it sooner. I think that both people, both myself and my brother, are super individual people, and he was just not ready, and then I was not ready, and then it was a given. Sorry, what were you gonna say?
Well, that really comes through in the documentary, you know, was that when back in the day, when you were being marketed, you were marketed as identical twins. You were so striking. You had the same hair. You know, there's album covers of you looking identical to each other. And it's kind of like you're being marketed as like this package. And then when this documentary came out, it's just kind of like you've got these two such like polar opposite personalities, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, coming from a point of view where when you were in Bros, you were marketed as kind of like identical twins. And then when you see the documentary, you see how different you are. I just thought it was just really interesting.
Well, first, thank you. I'm really proud of that film. We won the BAFTA and the National Film Award. We won Moment of the Year, BBC. It did so well. And we had a screening in Hollywood, an industry screening. I don't need to tell you guys what industry screenings are like. But it was full of people that, you know, just, you know, waiting to be impressed or very much unimpressed. They didn't really carry the way, but we had this screening, and afterwards we had just a standing ovation. It was an incredible reaction, and we were like, wow, I hope that the British public, this connects in the same way in some ways, because although it was funny in places and it was poignant, and you know, we hadn't addressed certain things like the passing of our mother. When my mother died, I think that we both cracked on. I was on Good Morning America 3 days after my mum died, and because we just had to dig in, and I was back on stage at Caesars within 7 days, and my brother was doing films, and we just didn't want to acknowledge that our best friend, you got to understand the way we were brought up, we really didn't have much. The one thing we had for sure was our mother's love, and we were the musketeers, me and my mother and my brother. And there was a story. Do you have a moment to tell you guys a story about when we were younger?
Yeah, go for it.
And, my mother showed me her purse, and she said, "We haven't got any money left, son. We've got 2 pence." It was 2 pence in her purse. So at the time, that was enough to make a phone call to our grandfather, my mum's father, and probably one of the most influential men in my life, outside my father as well. But he was. She was just leaning over the phone box, and it was pouring down with rain, and we were just shivering and scared and didn't know what was happening. We looked down, and there was £5 on the floor, and I remember just didn't quite know what the value was, but we knew that it would help. It was certainly more than what she just showed us in her purse. And we knocked on the window of the, and my mum at that point was just sobbing into the phone, and she went, "Wait," and she shouted us the first time. She never shouted us, and we just took a gamble. You know, a minute later we knocked again, just holding up this £5, and she went, "Dad, I gotta go," and she put the phone down, and we ran home in the rain, and we put this £5 note over our boiler. And this, as we waited for it to dry, it went like that, and it was 2 £5 notes, and that got us, I don't know, and my mum did it, but that got us through to a point where my mum got another job in it. You know, she was a hairdresser, and it was that kind of, with many, many, many of those memories, but just that was that kind of memory that created a bond that you may get to understand why me and my brother felt such a sense of loss when she died. I know many, many people I speak to lose their mother, and a lot of fellas. I was at a restaurant in London, and a fella just put his head on my shoulder and wept in the middle of a restaurant. And I'm very, very lucky that people seem like they can come up to me. But after that film, I can tell you the main demographic of that film was 18 to 35 year old men. And it's because I felt from it personally is that how much we just suppress our feelings, man. And we're not meant to be honest, and we're not meant to feel pain. And that movie was having therapy in front of a nation and in front of the world. Every single airplane in the world played that film. You know, it was like, it was, we addressed, sorry for the long-winded answer, but we addressed questions that we had suppressed so deep within our souls. We didn't think we would ever, certainly about the band, certainly about the way Luke felt about me being the front man. and obviously about our mother's grief and the loss of our sister who was killed by a drunk driver. We hadn't really spoken about these things because we just cracked on with making a living, building a career, and trying to numb ourselves to our pain and our grief. And that's the truth, and that's what that movie was. It wasn't bullshit. I mean, we were in deep pain during that film, and believe it or not, during those things called the master interviews at the end, when I'm looking down the barrel and Luke's looking down the barrel, that's called the master interview. That was a 5-hour interview. It breaks you down. And but we were trying terribly not to get emotional during those interviews purposely, because we didn't want to be seen to be weak, or that you could see the containment of pain, which is, I think, is even more painful.
I think that's because the image you had of Bros in the 80s and 90s was this kind of, you were both two, you had the blonde hair, and your image was kind of icy and it was kind of steely. And that was the kind of, you never really got a sense of you two as personalities or what you were like individually. You just had the image, right? It was all about the image of these two identical kind of steely looking icy figures. Whereas I think what the documentary does as well, it kind of opens the door a bit. And that's actually what you want from musicians and artists. You want them to know what they're like in reality. You don't want to have an image of someone. What audiences love, I think, is really to identify with the people on screen or the people singing. And but it almost seems crazy in hindsight that the image in the 80s and 90s was this steely kind of, like it was like there was a wall in front of the audience.
Well, there was a wall. I mean, that's what I said before. There was a wall. There was no, it was called media. The media, the only way, you would literally have to wait for the next big publication to print. So you have to imagine, without social media, you would correct, all you would want to do was correct the last interview and then correct the next interview and then correct. It was an endless cycle of self-defense. It was martial arts, mate. It was absolute martial arts. And now, thankfully, I've come through that. And I truly think success is longevity. I think, listen, I could have a number one record now. It might mean something on top of all the other stuff I've done. But if you just, you know, would I rather have a number one or know that I've got a place in the industry until I drop? I'd rather just know I've got a place in the industry until I drop, because I think most seasoned entertainers, and I'm sure you guys can relate, it's just about doing what we do. It's not about chart positions or getting attached to those things.
I think that's the goal. That's my goal, is to just keep working and doing what I love doing for the rest of my life, you know. And you get to the end of that, and if you can maintain doing what you love and what you're passionate about for that amount of time, that's the success. It's not about being, well, for you, it's not about like being on top of the pops, and it's not about being kind of like number one and being harassed by the media, but it's about the fact that you've been doing this for 30 years, and you know, over 30 years, and you've got a residency in Las Vegas, and you just, you know, you had this film that came out, and you know, you're doing incredible.
Thank you, mate. I mean, I'm proud, because we do, me and my brother try, and but if we do something, we always tend to create something. If you think about it, when we do come together, something happens. We've always managed to create something cultural, and whether you've seen it or not, After the Screaming Stops is a cultural film, you know. And to get GQ, so it's the greatest music documentary of all time, not, I don't personally think that, but I do think that to receive that kind of accolade from a publication like that isn't that it doesn't make me feel validated as an artist, but it is a relief that somebody sees the work that went into it by Full Well Films, you know, me and my brother, you know, we had to go and play. We sold two nights out in 7 seconds at the O2 before the film was made. So all of these things had to happen before that movie could even be made.
Sure.
And one of the things I wanted to just touch on in regards to respect for you guys is that that, you know, I want to give a shout out to you guys as artists, because I know a few comedians and stand-up comedians, and it's an incredibly cerebral process, and not being able to actually go out and release this artistry, which it is, which also sometimes gets overlooked. You know, stand-up comedians, there's a real deep cerebral connection to their humor, because humor, with humor you must be intelligent to even put those words together to somehow to get to the laugh. And so my thoughts are with you guys as well for not being able to go out there and let this out, because artists by definition are thinkers. So I hope that you guys are faring up okay as well.
Oh,
that's lovely.
That's lovely. But I think he was mainly aiming it at me, Nathaniel, right? So,
enough about me. What about me?
But what about, okay, so I mean, obviously the documentary is really moving, and but it's also really funny, and it's really entertaining. It's a really great film, and it's not just the fact that it is a good documentary, and it's not just the fact that it got like good reviews and it got good coverage. It was the fact that I think that it was released and then it came out on iPlayer, and it came on iPlayer over Christmas, and I think that a lot of people missed it when it first came out. And then when we were all at home at Christmas, it became this thing which was just everyone was... It was like a cultural touchstone.
Yeah, we touched it. I was from America. Like, I remember every day. I remember like there was like thousands of tweets about... And I'm like, what's... But my first initial reaction was, oh my God, what's wrong? You know?
Yeah.
And then... But I, you know, I think that it was just... It was something that was incredible to experience what that film did, but I do feel like me and my brother have become a lot closer for it. You know, we have.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That's incredible. That's like all these things. It's like I was saying before about knowing who you and your brother are more as individuals now than we ever did 30 years ago. But it's also the documentary, like all documentaries, a story, isn't it? It's like a proper narrative, and you've sort of invested in that. So it is that thing where, like, it's just storytelling, and that's what people love, and that's what people kind of invest in it when they see it, I think.
I think, thank you. And I think also things like the Stevie Wonder thing. I want to actually say to you guys about, I made a conscious decision to not be superstitious because of Stevie Wonder, that line that thought that was so funny. I want to explain, I am so still in tune with exactly that sentiment, because what happens is that is the example of a soundbite. Although I'm glad it stayed in the film that way, the reality is we had absolutely fuck all growing up. And our literature growing up, some people will not even know what I'm talking about, were the liner notes of albums. So when I was growing up, what I would read would be the lyrics, where it was made, who recorded it, the musicians on the album. And when you're coming from nothing, superstition, certainly in my family, crippled us. We were crippled by it. Like, you know, don't do this. Oh my God, don't do this. It was all fear-based philosophy, you know, which is superstition is fear-based. And I remember thinking the song was about that, thinking, oh good, it's good to be. And then he goes, if you believe in things that you don't understand, then you'll suffer. I remember thinking, oh fuck that, I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to walk under every ladder I can. And it really was, if you listen to the narrative, either side of that statement, I still stand by it. And I encourage people to not to live in a fearful place, because I think fear cripples us. It certainly cripples me. And whenever I fear fearful, I don't perform as well. Whenever I'm fearful, I don't feel as lucky. And I, my life doesn't seem to go quite as well.
How do you mean fear? What are you scared of?
Some people won't walk under a ladder. It's like, why? What's going to happen? And that's where the superstition thing came in. It was like, I mean fear as in all senses of the word. I think, you know, with self-isolation, you make movies in your mind, you make movies in your head, you play out scenarios, faith. You know, I questioned my faith after my mum died. You know, I think, me personally, I have a great deal of faith, but I do believe that religion is the nosy part of faith. Where I disconnect from religion, and attach myself to the word faith is because I'm not really interested in any in the details of the religion. I'm more interested in this in the soul of faith, and that can be very individual. My manager's an atheist, but he still has soul. You know, I'm not really interested in the details. I think it's one of the few things left that we have that are so remarkably individual and beautifully individual, and it's got me through a lot. My belief system is that I don't want to know the answers to those questions. I just have a certain feeling, and that's the telephone line to my family, to my mother, to my sister, to my grandfather, to my nana, to my bodyguard Johnny, you know, to the people I've lost, you know, many people I've lost. And so that's what I mean. It's like, you know, try and operate from a place with less fear. Fear is good in some ways, and in fact it energizes you, it can energize you, but I do think it stifles creativity and also dreams.
When Sergeant Pepper came out, that was the first album that put liner notes on and had lyrics on it, because it was that thing where it was that idea of the Beatles saying, this is where the lyrics are important, and this is what, and having that album cover that was both the picture on the front, and it had cutouts, and it had the lyrics. So it was almost like the package of the album itself was important. So it was not just a piece of music. It was like an artifact.
Yeah, well, you don't write a book. You don't, comedy, you don't write lyrics. You don't write... If it's meant to just fall upon deaf ears, then it might as well be vacuous. It's not meant to be vacuous. It's meant to fucking affect people. It's meant to make you want to... Listen, I've had some of my lyrics on the grave of somebody's father. I mean, where can you get a higher level of gratitude? I mean, it's meant to affect you, and I'm meant to be passionate.
It's great. Whenever I release any music, I always make sure that all of my liner notes have got the punctuation in the right places, so that, you know, so that people can read along. You know, I completely understand.
You know, I know that a lot of this stuff right now, and the reason why I do my lives every day is because I am not a big fan, really, ironically, of entertainment right now. I'm a fan of conversation, and I'm not a big fan of, oh, let's entertain. Like, let's just see if it happens to entertain, you know, because I think right now people just want to be spoken with, not spoken to, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what this show is.
I'm loving it. It's been my favorite interview of lockdown so far. Really, genuinely, you guys are phenomenal. I can actually just see it. I feel like getting carrying on.
To be fair, we really didn't know what to expect. And I think I'd be more nervous about interviewing you than a lot of our other guests. But you're lovely.
Thank you. As are you two, man. It's like really like I've just, as you can see, I was in my robe. I said to my manager, "Is this audio only?" It was like he says, "Yeah." I'm like, "Oh fuck it. I'm just going to press the video."
Well, it's good. It probably means you're more relaxed, right? You're probably more likely to say stuff.
My bedhead, the what I have left, but yeah.
So we've come to the end. So we've got. Have you got time for a quick game?
100%.
This is okay. The game is called Better or Worse, where you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion.
On your opinion?
Yeah, on my opinion. Just got to guess what I'm going to say.
Okay.
So starting with Robert De Niro. Paul McCartney, better or worse than Robert De Niro, in my opinion?
Better.
Better.
Better. George Clooney, better or worse than Paul McCartney?
Worse.
Worse, yeah. George Lucas, better or worse than George Clooney?
Better.
George Lucas, better.
Better, yeah. Bruce Willis, better or worse than George Lucas?
Worse,
yeah. High card. Bruce Lee, better or worse than Bruce Willis?
Better.
Oh, better.
Better. Spike Lee, better or worse than Bruce Lee?
That's tough.
I would say
better.
I'm saying Spike Lee is worse than Bruce Lee. Both high cards, good cards. Michael J. Fox, better or worse than Spike Lee?
Better. That's a feature cap for
laughter. That's a tough one. Much respect, but I would say you still go with Spike Lee.
I love Michael J. Fox. Elvis Presley, better or worse than Michael J. Fox?
Right. You gotta say Elvis.
Better.
Come on, Elvis.
Elvis, yeah. Tom Hanks, better or worse than Elvis?
I love
better,
Tom Hanks.
Better.
I still say Elvis. Elvis.
Elvis, still Elvis, of course. Tom Hanks is a high card. Aretha Franklin, better or worse than Tom Hanks?
Aretha Franklin, better.
Of course, yeah. I think that's incredible. I think you've got like nine, right? I think that's like you're one of the eight. You're one of the eight scorers, Matt. That incredible.
I think I got eight as well, actually. So I think we're
no,
even.
No,
I think that you think you got 10, bro, to be honest with you.
your single is out. You're raising money for the NHS, and you can get it off. There's a link on your Instagram. And one last thing. My friend Rebecca is an absolute massive fan of yours, and can you give her a shout out?
Hello, Rebecca. I'm Matt Goss. I am sending you all the love in the world, and please listen to my record and make babies.
Yes. thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you so much.
Much love to you both, and much respect to you. I've had the time of my life. Thanks for starting my day off like this, fellas.
Oh, right, yeah. It's
great. Well done. Thanks for coming.
Much love.
All right. See ya. Thank you very much.
Bye, guys.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.